My big idea was arrived at and pretty much decided upon at the age of 4, 1968 or so, when I discovered the Beatles. I decided I wanted to do that. I wanted to be the Beatles. At about age 12, I got my first guitar. A few years later, in high school, I was leading the high school rock band. There was only one. And then, flash forward to my early 20s, I graduated from NYU. I'm living in New York City by day, a lowly editor at a reference publishing company. By night, I'm chasing that dream, going to grubby rehearsal studios and practicing for gigs at grubby bars and grubby clubs in New York. And I was with my old high school buddy, Charles, and a whirling cast of singers and drummers and a saxophone. I played bass and sang. But I was chasing the dream with the distinct lack of common sense, partly my own musical snobbery, my own ignorance, and some poor social skills. Excuse me. So, sorry, I'm blanking here. But now that I've done it, I'll be smooth as a cucumber. So I'm really lost. So, in New York, thank you. I was in New York. Chasing the dream. I'm chasing the dream. Okay, well, I'll just start off with some of the impediments I put in front of myself. First, I wasted a great deal of time on naming the band. Now, every band, every musician wants to be in a cool band with a cool band name. And the problem is that when there's more than one people involved, it's impossible. And with me in the mix, it was even harder because I felt that the name was so crucial that I would demand that we change it at the first sign of its fallibility. So like the first name I picked was Open Rehearsal. I thought it sounded loose and casual and fun. But people coming to our first show kept asking me, is it an open rehearsal? Should I bring an instrument or, can I join in? So the next one was suggested by somebody in the band, The Waiting Room. The Waiting Room. Sounds kind of mysterious, right? But that name didn't pass the shout test. And the shout test is when you're calling the club and talking to the booker, and there's inevitably a sound check going on in the background. So it goes a little like this. So what's the band called? The Waiting Room. Waiting? Like waiting pool? No, waiting, like waiting pool. I mean, waiting room. So next, we were briefly children with knives, and I wish you'd been coming to our shows. Then RHR4, you can't blame me for that one. But then we picked Chalk Circle. Actually, I picked Chalk Circle, and everybody liked this name, Chalk Circle. You can sort of get an image from it. Our families liked it, our friends liked it, and so did the Toronto band that had been using it for years, unbeknownst to us. So finally, we settled on Big Bug, which was kind of a neat fit for a quirky dance rock band somewhere in the general vicinity of the B-52s, for instance. Not comparing us at all. But it was, it was a sort of lighthearted, also a neat little homage to my favorite Beatles, to the, Big Bug. So we stuck with that. And then the next problem is networking and promotion. I dreaded that aspect of the business. And it's something every performer has to face at some point. How to sell yourself, how to make yourself something that people will buy into. But I thought it was terribly uncool. And I figured that a true artist shouldn't have to bother themselves with this kind of thing. That, you know, I wanted Brian Epstein to walk in and discover me in the cavern club of my dreams and take away all the stuff I didn't like, naming the band, marketing, building an audience, and talking to club bookers. So this explains actually why my reaction to a tip that a friend gave me, you know, a place that you can go to meet lots of industry people, music industry people, hang out at this place in Midtown called the China Club. And my reaction was, well, you'll never catch me there then. This was the poser in me. The poser in me wanted Brian Epstein to discover me, wanted to be discovered and rescued, I guess you could say. Actually, another problem was my voice. I can carry a tune, and some people liked my singing just fine, but some people had no problem telling me to my face that I just wasn't a rock singer. I was of the opinion that in a business where Elvis Costello or David Byrne could be a professional singer, you may ask yourself, you know, I was good enough. But it did finally occur to me that I got a lot more compliments on my speaking voice than my singing. So we played gigs. We played at CBGB's and the Bitter End and the Village Gate. We had some good shows. I think one truly great show and plenty of shows. And I burned out. By the time I was in my late 20s, I felt washed up and over the hill. I eventually went back to performing, just me and acoustic guitar, playing solo. You might even have seen me somewhere around here in a cafe or bar or at the Inner Harbor. I played there a couple of summers. I even made a couple of albums. But the writing had been on the wall all this time. You never became the Beatles. And I figured a chubby 40-something wasn't probably going to storm the charts. It was time to face that fact. But luckily, facing that fact opened up the possibility of finding something a little better suited to my actual talents. So I started a podcast. Now, a podcast is just a digital, like, radio show. You can get from iTunes, download it to your iPod, listen anywhere you like. So with this, there's a forum where I get to write a lot, because I do write a lot. I used to constantly bug my band into learning new material because I wrote so many new songs. And now I get to write lots of material, sketches instead of songs, but sometimes music for the show, too. And I get to use my beloved speaking voice. And I also get to post something, and it's done, and I can move on. I picked the name The Inverse Delirium and stuck with it. So my original big idea does influence my current big idea after a misguided attempt to be a rock star. I use that experience to benefit my podcast, The Inverse Delirium, by deliberately doing the opposite of what I did as a musician. And here we are. Thank you.